Breakfast puppies?
We're all set to begin, so let's dive right in to Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes, gamer things and all the like. You can listen to it in your cars, but mostly it's about dive bars. Bikers, Dice, and Bars.
So, NPC, what are we drinking tonight?
Tonight, I have brought the drink, and it is a classic from me growing up in the good old southern lands of Alabama Stan. This is what I've always called a Crown and Crown, or some people call it a Royal Crown Royal. Some people call it Two Kings. There's a number of different names for it, but you can only really get so fancy when you're talking about Royal Crown Soda and Crown Royal Whiskey.
I actually kind of like the Royal Crown Royal. That's actually pretty clever.
Cheers, gentlemen.
So a little bit of story behind this. When you grow up in the South, you think of every soft drink as Coke. You go to a restaurant, you go to the drive-thru, they're asking you what you want, you place your order, they ask you if you want something to drink, you say, yeah, I'll have a Coke, and then they respond, what flavor? Then you respond, oh yeah, Sprite or orange, because everything is a Coke. Coke is synonymous with soda or pop in the South.
Really?
I believe that the Coca-Cola Corporation owns the entire Southeast United States in some way or another, especially Atlanta and the greater Atlanta and Georgia area.
Well, that would make sense.
But Crown Royal is one of those, Royal Crown, RC Cola is one of those things that you find at all of the lower income establishments that don't really want to pay the extra money to have actual Coca-Cola on their soda fountain machines. Dive bars
and have too much dignity for Pepsi.
RC Cola. Yeah. Hey, there's nothing wrong with Pepsi. I am an equal opportunity cola lover, except for Bethany. Bethany Cola, that weird ass, I think it's Italian variant of Coca-Cola. Yeah. Oh, that shit is nasty.
Unfamiliar. I actually really like Pepsi vanilla, so I'm going to shut up now.
What I brought this evening Coca-Cola is RC Cola, a couple of 2 liters. We've got Crown Royal, which everybody knows is the best dice bag because it comes with free whiskey. And I also brought some Crown Royal vanilla in case we want to mix it up later in the evening.
Oh, yeah.
And Xander, welcome back to the podcast. This is a very special gift. Your own special cream-colored vanilla dice bag from Crown Royal.
You know what I was actually going to give you guys today?
Well, you gave us some delicious empanadas. And thank you for
my
that.
God, those empanadas.
Oh, and for the record, hi, I'm Nathaniel, also known as NPC. You're listening to Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Sitting to my left, as always,
just Jacob. And to my left,
Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
Welcome back to the show. We're
so happy
glad you're feeling
be
better. And you have gifts.
Blanton's whiskey bags.
Oh, my God.
So you wouldn't have to have.
I am unfamiliar with this.
So Blanton's also makes these bags as well, except this is Blanton's and they're dark brown colors that kind of look a little bit more like leather, which is kind of cool.
They're very nice.
But they're still the same felt. And I'd actually brought you guys a pair and I thought I had them in my pannier, but I don't. So as soon as you gave me this bag, I thought, oh, that's right. I got you guys things. And then I think I left them at home.
The $70 dice bag is leather and comes with really expensive Crown Royal. Yes. I didn't buy that dice bag today.
wait. Here's one. Oh.
Oh. So, oh, wow. That's nice. Can I keep this?
That's for you.
That's for me? Oh, thanks, Xander. Welcome back.
I know I had one more, so I was going to get you one too, Jacob. And
we'll square up.
I'm just going to reach around in my bag some more for a second, see if I can find it. There's a lot of weird shit in there. There's like a couple locks. There's some bike lights. There's a timber scarf. I don't know.
We'll take a pause while Xander gives his bag a reach around.
But yeah, this is just basically whiskey and Coke. There's nothing special about it, except that their names are interchangeable. And it's a staple. This is what I grew up. This is what I drank in my 20s when I lived in the South. It was super easy, and it wasn't really top shelf. and it came with a good dice bag.
I mean, and I actually do enjoy Royal Crown a lot. So I grew up drinking RC Cola.
RC Cola is essentially the standard for me. It's what's on most of the guns at most of the bars. And it's, you know,
it's great.
It's great. RC, if you're looking to sponsor a podcast, just hit us up at breakfastpubbies.com.
It wasn't until I was in my late teens, almost 20s, that I found out that Royal Crown was cheap soda.
I didn't realize it was cheap soda either. I always thought it was, you know, that kind of hidden gem that no one else really knew about. Because I'm West Coast and there's not a lot of RC out there.
Well, part of it was
but I found it and it was great.
The plant my dad worked in had a soda machine that, despite it being 1992, still charged a quarter for a can of Coke. If it was a Coke product, it was a quarter. If it was a Pepsi product, it was 45 cents. If it was RC Cola, it was 45 cents, which gave me this thing that, like, RC Cola was this weird, more expensive soda, so I ended up drinking a lot of Coke, because Coke, and since from being a very young person back in the early 80s, I'd get a Coke whenever I got a quarter to get a Coke. Every time I ran in to get my dad's paycheck, I'd always get the Coke because I couldn't afford an RC. So this mentally programmed me to think that RC Cola was like this more expensive high-end brand. And since we were Poe.
Fascinating. It's all of the mom-and-pop chains, all the mom-and-pop establishments in my hometown had RC.
Yep.
Yeah, you didn't really have Coke or Pepsi on the gun unless it was a chain that was a little bit better to do.
Yeah, I mean, in my hometown, the cheap, quote-unquote, soda was Pepsi, because Burnick's PepsiCo was one of the last independently owned bottling operations for Pepsi-Cola, where it was not a sublease or any of the other weird ways that Pepsi basically owns all of their factories. They were a third generation Pepsi company, family owned company. And they did all of their own local delivery. They did all of their own local delivery contracting. And because of that, they got to make their own rules. And so they had a good corner on the market. A lot of them operate on this weird version of what amounts to a franchisement, and even a lot of the long-term companies, at some point they got bought out, and when they bought out, they had to relicense with Pepsi, and they had to license under the new terms. So unless it was like under the same owner or ownership continuously, they've had to swap over to the weird distribution system.
I just want to say how much I enjoy that you are such a random fountain of just the weirdest information.
I do one thing well, and that's win at Trivial Pursuit.
You know, if I were to make my dream trivia team, you would be on it. My friend Brendan Monahan would be on it, because that dude, I mean, I will hand it to people who don't drink. Their ability to retain lots of knowledge is shocking.
Yeah, no, it's weird. I've been on a couple trivia teams, not since here in Portland, but back home. And it'd be like, the team was made up of people, and it's like, this is our math guy, and this is our sports person, and this is, and then there's Jacob for when they ask us who discovered deuterium.
There's Jacob. We call him Mr. Catchall.
Anyway, let's take this to the road. Hey, Jacob. Let's go on a tour.
Oh, sure. What sort of touring would you like to do?
Oh, let's start in-state. And depending upon how much fun we have, we might go interstate.
Oh, awesome. Just to define our terms here, touring is the act of traveling by bike, motorcycle, or bicycle over an extended distance and for more than an overnight. In fact, many people who tour both by bicycle and motorcycle stay that you have to be out on the road 4 days before you're really touring. Otherwise, it's a commute with an overnight.
I will say, though, that if you are physically bicycling for 2 days. I don't care if it's there and back. That's a long time in the saddle.
I'm weak sauce. I consider even traveling to the coast on my own for an overnight stay, to me, that's a tour.
Right.
On a motorcycle.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
However, the longer you're going away from your base, the more it changes how you tour, what you need to take into account, and what you need to pack.
Well, I'm sure the logistics are probably infinitely greater the longer you're out on the road, because whether you're on bicycle or motorcycle, your space is limited. You are not in a vehicle. You have no trunk.
Right.
You have basically, what, saddlebags and underneath the seat? Do motorcycles have underneath the seat? Scooters do.
Depends on the motorcycle.
Okay.
Usually not. Saddlebags, tank panniers, and tail bags and handlebar bags are what you see use. And
sidecar.
Sidecar. Yep. And then there's two sorts of touring or that blend. Are you touring with camping or are you touring with overnight in either crash space or a hotel?
Right.
And those are two other factors.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a tent alone is a huge one.
Oh, you know, yeah.
Before I developed a dependency upon a machine in order to sleep in my advancing years, I used to actually kind of like the idea of camping with a motorcycle to the point that I had been pricing out this attachable camping tent that was for one person and a motorcycle.
Yep.
It looks so awesome.
It covers both your motorcycle and your tent.
I had even considered getting a mount so I could pull a motorcycle towable teardrop kind of thing.
Awesome.
But not anymore, you know.
The first thing you need to consider when touring is what sort of touring are you going to be doing? Are you going to be doing road touring or are you going to be doing any unimproved road / logging trail touring? We're not going to talk about adventure touring because that's like a whole separate animal.
Which is?
Adventure touring involves going off-road, or at the very least, it's like what you see when you see the Silk Road, the Road of Bones, the Long Way Around, the Long Way Down, any of those. We're going to go several thousand miles, and big chunks of it are going to be across things that are at most a goat track.
Xander, have you seen Long Way Around or Long Way Down?
No. All those things you just said are unfamiliar to me.
I could possibly devote an entire episode to talking about how much I love it, but I'm going to give you the short spin of it. Ewan McGregor and his buddy Charlie Borman, they, in 2004, made a documentary of them getting on two motorcycles and riding from London into Europe, east across Russia and Mongolia, and then flying from the fur tip of Russia to Alaska, and then riding from Alaska through Canada, through the U.S. to New York City. And it's an amazing documentary.
Okay, then.
And then 3 years later, they did it again. They called it Long Way Down, where they rode from the northernmost tip of Scotland all the way down to the southernmost tip of Africa.
That's awesome.
It's pretty awesome. And it's quite an experience watching it. You feel like you have bonded with these guys and their road crew and their fucking cameraman. He's the best. Anyway, we'll talk about it at a later time. You should watch it at some point.
That kind of sounds like the crazy adventures of the Belgian armored car division in World War One.
It often is. Yeah. Yeah.
They go through so much, but for me, I watched that and it's like, just okay, I'm just going to pause this, go get up a motorcycle and ride around the city for a while and come back, because it just makes me want to get out and ride.
Touring can be done a lot of ways. In fact, an acquaintance of mine, Liza, from the Recycle Garage crew down in Santa Cruz, has once or twice now gone to Pakistan to do tours on Pakistani manufactured motorcycles. That's kind of hardcore and extreme in a whole different way that you don't want to even get into.
Are they that bad?
Brass is involved on structural components at times. Now, my understanding, Xander, is that you're starting to get into bicycle touring.
I'm starting to get into longer bicycle rides. So the other day, I did a 26-mile ride, which was the longest single bike ride I've ever done before. And the first thing I instantly noticed was, my gloves suck. My butt hurts, and I'm really glad that I didn't wear a three-piece suit today. So I started to go and realize that there were a couple of central things that I needed, because I used to make fun of those people that would have, you know, the spandex shorts and the super bright I'm on the Tour de France, you know, ride, and like their stupid looking neon gloves. And I just used to go and shake my head at those people and go like, okay, boy, are you special.
You know, I used to make fun of those as well until I got a set of padded biking pants. Oh, a total game changer. It totally changes everything.
Yeah, so I can't find physical pants. I've only found biking shorts, which I'm a little bit...
Get the shorts. Get them from Amazon. They're like significantly cheaper than if you go to any kind of a bike store. They'll want to charge you like $90 for a pair that you can get on Amazon for $20.
Okay, good to know. But then I was just at a bike store today, and like, well, if you want to still have the protection of pants, but you still want the paddings of these shorts, may I introduce you to padded underwear?
And part of it is the season you're shopping. They do make good touring pants for bicyclists.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not a winter thing, but I don't like riding with super amounts of exposed skin, especially over long distances.
Oh, come on. You know, there's lots of skin donors out there.
Yeah, I like my skin. It's pretty.
So you've clued into one of the two big things that change when you start touring. And that is suddenly the gear that gets you around for short distance commuting and short distance riding doesn't cut it anymore.
No, it does not.
that weird little pucker seam in a set of gloves that really doesn't bother you all that much when you're just hopping to work suddenly will drive you crazy after the fourth hour. You will start to find everything you hate about every piece of gear, and you'll often find the breakpoints. You'll find that ratchets on helmets don't last, actually, because they're not designed for the long time vibration. You know, for those of you who don't know what a helmet ratchet is, on many helmets, there's a knob on the back of your head that you crank to tighten or loosen.
Yeah.
On cheaper helmets, that'll jostle back and forth and wear itself out pretty quick.
And you might also suddenly discover that your helmet makes a whining sound at high speeds. Suddenly you're like, what is this sound? And then you realize it's simply because of a slight displacement with the visor and where it sits on connected to the helmet. And when it's closed, suddenly there's this whine as the wind goes right through this tiny little displacement. And then you get rid of that helmet because you hate it forever after that day.
Yep.
Been there.
But the other half of the equation is the bike itself. And this applies to bicycles and motorcycles. You know, you start to learn that routine maintenance is not something you can skimp on. You start to understand why someone will pay the extra couple bucks for a high-end chain. I grew up around a couple people who toured, so it wasn't new to me, but I know a lot of people who go, oh yeah, I want to get into touring. I'm just going to be on the road. I'm going to get myself a dual sport. I'm going to be able to go out for 2 weeks. And why the hell does anyone need a chain oiler? Until they go dry chain in the middle of Montana, in the middle of nowhere, and suddenly have a chain disintegrate on them because of accumulated dust and are listening to their engine burn out as they're trying to get to the side of the road and shut her down. So touring is its whole set of challenges. Gear is a lot more expensive. You're going to go through multiple sets of gear to find what actually works for you personally. There is something.
Sounds like a lot of trial and error.
There's a lot of trial and error because it's a very personal thing and a personal experience.
I got another one. When you suddenly discover that your trusty rain pants leak.
Yep.
And then you arrive at your destination looking like you pissed yourself.
At least if it's pouring down rain and you walk in like that, I think there's a little bit of a better excuse for that. But I get what you're saying.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well,
it's not a good look.
No. No, it's not a good sensation. Right? Because you're riding in the rain and the rain is filtering off of the entirety of your body except your crotch. And it's now in your underwear and it's now starting to dribble inside your rain pants down your leg to your boots. That sucks.
And that leads us to medical conditions that you'll find out the wonders of when it gets to touring. For many motorcycle riders out there, not so much sport bikers, but dual sports and especially cruisers, if you're riding long distance, you're more prone to jock itch.
Oh, yeah. You got to keep that gold bond in your saddlebag.
Conversely, bicyclists, you discover the wonders of chafing on your calves.
You also need some Tiger Balm, because you're going to get some wrist cramps.
Yep.
Either that or a throttle lock or one of those wrist levers that you can latch onto your handle. However, those freak me out.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I've used it once and it worked, but I was just like, you know what? I'm just too freaked out by this because it could go at any moment.
I do have a pretty good picture of me getting prepared for a long bike trip.
Ooh.
If you guys want.
We're totally going to be posting this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. How long was that bike scooter?
Wow. You look like you're riding off to war.
So we will be posting this picture, but this also brings up another issue that is especially true for bicyclists, but not as true for motorcyclists. Matters for both, though. Suddenly, weight and bulk become huge factors.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, I was a backpacker growing up.
I've done that before.
And I came from a family that was kind of insane about it. Like, so how much of the handle of the toothbrush can we cut off, and how many ounces does that save us?
Oh, speaking of long way round, when they're planning the trip, the entire first two episodes, I think, are them planning the trip.
Mm-hmm.
And they are going through, like, every gram of weight. It's just like trying to figure out, oh, we can't take this thing because it's going to do this. And yeah.
You see, people go and kind of criticize a lot of, you know, certain tabletop role playing games for making you go and piece out every piece of weight of equipment you take as an adventure.
We call that coin weight encumbrance. Yes,
yeah. And then you realize, but I guess that makes sense.
Yes.
You know, in a way, I guess preparing for a tour, being a tourer is similar
to
being
two different.
Yeah, no. I got a sudden brain train, and I'm going to follow.
NPC is having a brainstorm. Stand back.
There's tourers, yep. Tourists, not tourists. No, Tory McBingbings. there's touring riders, and there's casual riders or recreational riders. People who ride for recreation or for commuting, they want the more instant fulfillment kind of RPGs, where it's like, let's just go into the dungeon and kill some monsters and kick ass. Whereas touring riders are similar to the old school adventure planning players who want to know where their hatchet is. They want to write down on their character sheet what bag contains what item, where it is, and manage all of that stuff. It suddenly makes sense.
And then there's no support.
Bring it all together.
And then there's no support adventure riders, and those folks play Phoenix Command.
Oh, yeah.
So we've talked a little bit about what's important to consider when touring, but let's talk about why touring. Why would you want to do that? Why would you want to get out on a bike, be it a bicycle or a motorcycle, for a long period of time away from home and just go for 3, 4, 5 days. Why would you want to do that?
Because it's awesome.
Why?
It just feels good. So you get out, you got your brain space, you're out on your own. You feel like you are on an adventure. It feels great.
I mean, for me, when I've taken my bicycle on adventures, usually with my wife, to me, when you go out and buy bicycle, because it's a lot slower than, you know, it's slower than driving, but it's faster than walking is basically where it is, and not much faster than walking. You get to see a lot more. You get to take in a lot more. You know, you get the smells, you get the sights of the city, the sounds of the city, and you really get to go and be like, oh, I'm just going to go down this street really quickly because I can and see what's down there. And it's, you know, it's fun to ride. And you can also just get a whole bunch of interesting reaction to you as well when you're out there, because people want to know, what are you doing in my city with a bicycle? And there's not a lot of bike culture there, for instance.
And on a motorcycle, like a long ride, and imagine it's the same with a bicycle, the difference between road tripping in a car and road tripping on a motorcycle is that you feel the temperature change every time you go over a bridge, over a stream. Every time the highway turns, you feel it. And, you know, for a really long tour through the countryside, it's just cathartic.
Mm-hmm.
That connection to the world around you.
Yeah.
There's also something that applies equally to bicycles and motorcycles, which is your connection to the bike. When you get out there and put the miles on, you learn more about your bike and how you and your bike interact. And for those of us who truly are bikers, whatever sort of biker there is, and I have to say I'm doing somebody a disservice because I know a unicyclist tourer. Yeah.
How?
Why?
Because, well, the why is the easy one. The mountain was there. The how is long and involved. It involves ultralight backpacking equipment. But you learn a whole new appreciation for motorcycling and how your motorcycle operates. And you and your motorcycle or bicycle end up with a much stronger bond.
To me, it really is kind of the modern day equivalent of you and your horse.
Having done long distance horseback riding, it's exactly like it.
You get to know every little, you know, every little tick, every little sign of, oh man, something's about to happen. I know this sign. When the old mare neighs like that, you know it's not a good sign.
I love it. Yeah, it is a lot like having a trusty steed.
Yeah.
Any other advice for prepping for a tour? Like any thoughts about how you want to get ready for such an undertaking?
There are three things that no matter which method you're using for touring, you have to make sure you have. You need a toolkit appropriate for your bike.
Absolutely.
You need water. You need water that's appropriate for your distance. And the last thing is you need to let people know where you're going.
And when you're supposed to be there, approximately.
Yeah.
I would say you need a fourth item, which is a first aid kit.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's most people would agree that. With that. And personally, I say that. I know a bunch of people who don't. I think they're stupid, but
just having some hemorrhoid cream and some, you know, antibacterial smear, a few bandages, just in case, you know.
And I mean, I'm not going to argue with that at all. I mean, as someone who rolls around with my crash bag, including a windlass tourniquet and an Israeli combat bandage, you know, it's I'm down.
You gotta be prepared for the basics. But yeah, and if you're on a bicycle, you need a patch kit. You gotta have a tire patch
kit and a pump.
Yeah. Oh, and if you're on a motorcycle, you need a patch kit.
Well, I've never even thought about patching up a motorcycle tire on the road, but that's...
if it's tubeless, it's not that big a deal.
Okay.
And if you're on a motorcycle, pack a gas bailout bottle.
Pocket battery for your phone, a sandwich for later.
Yep.
A change of socks. Trust me. Possibly two changes for a long ride because they're going to get swampy.
You need more underwear and socks than you think you do.
You really do. You could only flip them inside out for so long.
That said, don't be afraid to wash them in the creek.
Bringing this to the gaming table, I want to talk about something that is very near and dear to my heart, and that is the concept of the gaming group. Tabletop role-playing group or your board gaming group or whatever, your recurring gaming group as a major point of social hub, your major method of interacting with most of your friends. And I think a lot of gamers who game a lot can relate to that. That's kind of probably how they establish their group of friends and how they manage most of their social relationship is through gaming or the gaming table. Hell, it's how I met both of you.
And that's why we're all here today, kids.
The gaming group is, to me, something that is very important in my life. Like, when I moved here back in 13 years ago, I drove across the country with everything that I felt like keeping in the back of a Chevrolet S10 pickup truck. And my best friend rode with me in order to keep me sane. And that was a fantastic trip. Maybe I'll talk about it at length some other time. But after I moved here, unpacked, and got everything settled, within a week, I was online trying to find a gaming group. Posting at the time in like Yahoo groups,
I know,
Live Journal, even Craigslist, looking for gamers. Everyone in this town that I see regularly, that I choose to continue interacting with, that, you know, the top 20 people on my phone list are probably people that I've met through my gaming groups. Can you relate to this?
Yes, I can. I to a certain extent, not to the same degree, just because I've always been this weirdo who lives a very intersectional lifestyle where I have a large number of close acquaintances and good friends who are very divergent in their interests. And so over the course of a week, I will hang out with people who think gaming is the dumbest thing in the world. And we just like to hang out and turn wrenches. And
for those of you listening at home, both NPC and I are just shaking our heads at that last statement.
God.
We're just the worst.
That's offensive.
Harumph, harumph, harumph.
And then, you know, when I'm out at the range, you know, it's with folks who are still somewhere stuck in the 1980s thinking the satanic panic was a real thing. But I've been with gaming groups where the only time I saw those people was when I was sitting at the gaming table. That said, gaming groups have been a regular and consistent centerpiece of social circles I've had.
It's fascinating because I know so many people that are gamers, that are wrenchers, that are shooters. They have this intersection of hobbies, like all of these things that they're like super nerdy about. You're one of these people. I know that Mike's one of these people. Mm-hmm. Matthew from another podcast, he's one of these people. The intersection was so frequent that we started this podcast. Yes. About intersection.
There's a reason why we kind exist. Of cultures.
Xander?
So as a social hub for me, gaming was much more kind of in my high school days where all of my friends were gamers. All the gamers I knew were my friends. And so we frequently gamed together and we built computers together, played online games together. We did role-playing together. It was much more kind of the core of my social group. And then when I left town and moved all the way up here, that became NPC over here who found me on LiveJournal. God. I've been on LiveJournal for so long that my name is Halloween.
Yeah, he had a really cool name.
Were either of you on Tribe?
Tribe sounds really familiar.
Okay.
It kept trying to advertise to me. So yeah, I remember, oh my God, I haven't thought about Tribe in a very long time. It was an odd website. Yeah. I was a LiveJournal person.
Yeah, me too.
I miss
the good old days of LiveJournal. The damn Portlanders community on Facebook is garbage.
It's just not the same.
Garbage.
Yeah.
You're garbage people on there. Anyways.
If you're a damn Portlander on Facebook and you'd like to have a word with us, no.
Or no, you're garbage people. Oh, God. I was there before you even came here. I was there.
You were talking about school. When I was in middle school, most of my friends were kind of like hit and miss. And then as soon as I got a gaming group together, it was just like, all right, we're now best friends. And then we started bringing people in and that became how we socialized. And then in high school was kind of the same. It was mostly just a little bit branching off here and there. I didn't have that many games in high school until my senior year. I moved to a new high school. I hated my high school that I was at. I went to a new high school in my same town, and I remember I was brand new to the school. I ended up at this party at a friend of mine's, and I didn't know anybody there but my buddy who invited me, and there was this trio of really cool goth punk looking people on the other side of my buddy's rich ass swimming pool, just sitting over there smoking. I was like, I must be friends with them. So I go and sit down and start talking with them. And they all seemed really cool. And we instantly hit it off. And then the very next day, I hang out with them at school because they all go to my school somehow. And we ended up at one of their house after school. And the guy looks over to me and says, "So, you play Palladium?" And it's like, do I fucking ever? And that became the beginning of a wonderful friendship. And then again, it was the gaming group as the social hub.
Yeah. I mean, when I first moved here, that was kind of the situation with you and a lot of people that you then introduced me to, then that I also introduced you to, was just through gaming. And so the core group of friends I had here when I first moved here was because of gaming. People like Christina Riot, Chris Street when he moved up here.
Yeah. Lots of really cool people that we've had come in and out of our gaming table.
Yeah, I love all those people. They're all really good people. Yeah. But much like Jacob, I think my group of friends is just so weird and dynamic that I have the same people that have never touched a pair of dice outside of Monopoly. And I have people that have never even done gaming at all. And I have people that, you know, they want to put their toes in the water, but maybe that's about it. And then I have friends who do nothing but game, and it's lovely. But I have a very weird, as I'm sure you probably saw at my birthday, a weird dynamic group of friends.
You have a pretty awesome dynamic group of friends, yes.
So one of the interesting things that I'm picking up here is that when both of you moved to Portland, you rapidly had either reestablished a gaming community for yourselves.
We had to.
Or it actually kicked into a higher gear than what you had prior to moving here.
I think both of those things are true.
I had some really awesome people that I played with back east, but I don't think I had a steady gaming group there. I had a handful of people that I really liked gaming with, and I guess I can also associate that to significant levels of depression and unhappiness that I had out there. I wasn't able to regularly get my creative fix through gaming for me.
Yeah.
When I moved here, it was just gaming. I established a group, I got some really cool players, and I game all the time.
Do you find there to be a strong link between a lack of creative outlet and depression?
Yes, absolutely. I have to be creating something, even if it's just a shared story.
Yeah. Yeah. I've come across a lot of similar things with myself lately, and I feel like it's something that's not maybe talked about enough, that creative outlets are maybe one of the best antidepressants out there.
Interesting you should say that, because what I was getting to with my earlier question about your experiences moving to Portland is moving to Portland nearly killed gaming for me.
Hmm.
I went from gaming regularly to having no gaming group, and for a lot of different reasons, having a lot of problems getting connected with a gaming group. And that was despite the classic pound the brick and mortar and that sort of thing.
When did you move to Portland?
2007. So, I mean, part of it was timing. I moved in at 2007 when the Portland was starting to stop being Keep Portland Weird. And we were rolling into the Great Recession, which,
yeah,
you know, made it harder on everyone.
Yeah.
But I was kicking around town I went without anything more than the occasional board game for nearly 3 years.
I mean, there was a pretty great bumper sticker I saw the other day, which I really kind of took to heart and want to, you know, help. And it just said, "Make Portland shitty again."
Yeah. And yes, bring back the corruption of the 1950s.
Hell, man, I'd take it, bring it back to like the early 2000s and 1990s when this was just like kind of still kind of a not just kind of a weird backwater town of just being dingy and dirty. That's why I moved here.
Well, we're all transplants. So, I mean, in our own way, we have contributed to the gentrification of this town, mm-hmm. the change, the Californiation of.
Why Portland. You gotta look at me when you say that?
I'm just gonna let that silence hang there a little longer. You can edit
I've been
that
here
later.
Longer than any of you.
Anyways, the other thing is that sometimes gaming groups create social hubs for reasons you're not expecting. Like, there's the usual, okay, I game with these people, so yeah, I'm going to ask them to do some other things, and you kind of naturally grow a circle of friends out of that. I've had a couple gaming groups that were rather intimate in a platonic sense. There's been a couple of great gaming groups that were not In a platonic sense.
I, too, used to play vampire.
It wasn't vampire.
I, too, used to play Shadowrun.
Let me tell you about... we'll have an off-the-mics conversation about about failed saving throws.
Okay. All right, keep going.
But, like, one of the tightest groups I ever had was not intentionally put together this way, but we realized after about the fourth session that we had accidentally tripped into a group of people who every last one of us was dealing with some level of post-traumatic stress disorder and was using gaming came to the table using gaming as a way to process some of that out. It gave us that controlled fix of excitement and risk and adrenaline in a controlled setting, and it let us process out a lot of stuff. And that's true of many things in folks' lives, but there's a role for that.
Just as a quick aside, I think this is a really interesting spin off of what we started off talking about. Maybe it's a part of it.
Yeah, if you want to do therapy and gaming sometime, like I'm active.
Again, that's my one big little break here for a second. Like, do we think this is an important enough topic to make it its own separate topic at another time, or do you want to keep it a part of this?
Let's just keep going. Let's just follow this where it goes.
Yeah, because I really like this, but I think it's a really important topic as well.
I'm active with a couple groups that do gaming for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and a couple groups that are working on bringing gaming into therapeutic modalities for some mental health disorders.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's a really important thing too, because I know that especially when I was gaming with Nathaniel a lot, you know, there were some things that I was dealing with where I felt that gaming was the best, most therapeutic way to kind of work through things in a setting that was free.
Yeah.
In a setting that was, you know, fantastical, in a setting that was no judgment, and in a setting where, you know, people might not have known that's what I was dealing with. People might not have known that that's what I was working out. And it didn't matter because it was a story and we were role playing and it helped me a lot. And so that's another reason that I love gaming with Nathaniel so much. It's just that every single time I've done it, you know, it's been not only inspiring, but also personally helpful.
So I know that Jacob has only ever experienced me as a GM in a murderous bastard role because of the game that you joined us in. However,
you and your fucking dice.
I am 100% the same. Gaming for me, both in middle school and high school, but especially in my early 20s.
Yeah.
Gave me an outlet to pursue personal identity issues that I didn't want to talk to anybody else about. Issues that I was dealing with that affected my mentality, my sanity, and my levels of happiness. And being able to live certain things out at the table, it was interesting because I don't think the rest of the group even understood what I was saying, what I was doing, or why I was doing it. They just thought I was playing some weird ass characters, and I played some weird ass characters. But it really put a lot of shit in perspective for me.
Yeah,
and you know, this goes beyond folks who are grappling with real significant personal challenges. I mean, as a game master, there's been twice now where the Shadowrun party has got just at the drop of a hat executed their Johnson, which for those of you who don't know, Johnsons are the cutouts who employ Shadowrun parties. And I've looked at the group and went, all right, who just had a bad day with their boss?
Now, bringing this back to the social hub concept, I've experienced the same thing with a whole group. With many games that have been long going with a group that got to know each other very well, that came together and was like, we want to have this experience and we want to have it together because each of us is going through something right now and each of us needs this game to do a certain thing for us. We don't really want to sit down and talk about it. Sure, we can go out for beers afterwards like we usually do and hash through some things. And, you know, in a close-knit group that is your social group, the people that you hang out with, you're going to go out after the game. And if it was a deep one, someone's going to say, hey, man, that was fun and interesting, but do you want to talk about that? If not, it's fine.
Yeah.
And sometimes you do. And sometimes that ends up with, you know, people walking over outside to have a cigarette, which turns into 12. And then that ends up with a group growing closer. Yeah. And I know we're pushing the limits on this. And I've got more to say eventually about the concept of the group falling apart and what it can do for social circles. But let's stick to the therapeutic aspect of it. I like where this has gone. This was unexpected. Gaming is my outlet for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I find that I write games differently at different times based upon my mindset and based upon what's happening in my life. And I know so many people in the indie gaming circuits that do the same. Like, you can look at any person that is, you know, a prolific indie writer that puts out multiple things, and you can actually follow their mental state sometimes through the games that they create. And so even playing games, creating games, talking about games, it's...
I'm going to quietly hope that that is not a universal constant. Otherwise, somebody should be locking me up.
Well, and that's one of the things, too, that I've appreciated with even computer RPGs as they become much more dynamic, in which, you know, if you just don't want to play the person that kills everybody all the time and you want to play that really charismatic character, or you want to go and really, you know, stat build to the character that you actually really want to play, that the bigger and more complex these games are becoming, you know, if you can't find a gaming group, you can still feel like you're part of a role-playing arena.
So much of what we've talked about has revolved around in-person at the table games, board games, role-playing games especially. And if we look back at a previous episode when we had Christina Riot on, the guild mistress extraordinaire, you know, that gave us a glimpse of what it looks like in that setting. But I want to touch about a very small particular backwater that is near and dear to my heart. Did either of you ever participate in LAN parties?
Oh, I did. I had a number of LAN parties. We had them all throughout my late teens, and then again into my 20s. And I think I assembled a couple here in Portland.
Yeah, I, in high school especially, because my tabletop group also did a lot of LAN parties. We did a lot of Counter-Strike, I guess, but also did a lot of Dota back in the day. A lot of Command and Conquer.
Oh, yeah.
I got some good epic stories about Command and Conquer.
Yeah, no, one of the things I liked is in that sliver of time before broadband internet was available in folks' homes.
Yeah.
And, so, you know, you'd be like somebody's garage or taking over somebody's house.
Who's stepping on the coax?
Crashing at a buddy's house after an evening of running coax from room to room, figuring out which outlets are on which circuits, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that was a special sort of social hub because
it was,
you know,
I forgot about that.
It was amazing because you spent the entire time staring at screens interspersed with immense close contact with other people.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, that was a particular sliver where I have friendships that were created in that.
I keep
track of those people to this day.
Firewall.
I want to close the section out by just giving a shout out to all of the wonderful people I've met through gaming.
Yeah.
All of my best friends throughout time, I've either met through a game or through a conversation about a gaming that led to a friendship.
Yeah.
And I met both of you through gaming. I met the best man at my upcoming wedding through gaming. I didn't meet my partner through gaming, but.
Well, we can't have everything.
We can't have everything. But so many people, I met my best childhood friend through conversations about gaming. It's been the thing. It's been my life. Like, I know that I diversify and I have many other interests, but this is always the one that connects me the most to people.
Yeah. I'm going to give another shout out to you, NPC, just by the fact that, you know, when I first moved here, I was kind of lost. And I felt that your post that brought me into your gaming circle helped me a lot when I first moved here. And I enjoyed every single game I was allowed to be in with you. It's just, And again, like not just for finding friends, but also working through things I had to work through.
Yeah.
So thank you.
And now we're going to take it to the bar. Xander, take it away.
Our topic today is going to be about karaoke bars.
Oh, God damn it.
One of my favorite topics ever.
Jesus.
You're Christ. A little off tune there, Jacob. Well,
that would be part of the reason why I don't like karaoke bars, sir.
So I've had a weird history with karaoke bars in the city. The first time I did karaoke in Portland, I think I was 19 or 20 years old. I was at a friend's wedding. They drugged me to Cheers Northwest because it was a huge group. I didn't get carded. Yeah. I was fed a lot of red wine that I did not like.
Oh.
That got me drunk. And then I sang a lot of Talking Heads. And
well, you know, like you do.
Like you
yeah.
do.
Yeah.
In fact, my version of Life During Wartime by Talking Heads was so notorious that I used to go to Suki's Bar and Grill when I was at Portland State University.
Oh, I loved Suki's. I used to work around the corner from there. Yeah.
In fact, they go to my job for their annual holiday party, and they are a great group of people. I used to do Life During Wartime there so often and apparently so well that when I would go back there a couple weeks later, there was a gay couple that would always request me to go and sing that for them again because they loved it so much, to the point where I started bringing different passports with me because I've got, one of the lines is mentioning, like, I've got a couple of passports, a couple of visas, so I'd, like, pull out Visa credit cards, and I made it a whole show, and I think we've all been to that karaoke bar where that person goes and puts on that show, and that show is usually awesome.
I'm kind of a karaoke diva.
I know.
I just really enjoy singing. I took voice lessons as a kid. I was in musical theater. I haven't really done anything else with that except for get on a microphone and talking to a podcast and karaoke. There were some drag performances for a while there, too, but that was mostly just lip syncing. It wasn't quite the same. David Allan Coe is my go-to. David Allan
Which
Coe.
One?
You don't have to, you never even call me by my name.
Do you know who originally wrote that?
Steve Goodman.
Yes!
A friend of mine named Steve Goodman wrote that song, and he told me that, anyway, I know the whole song by heart, and that's even a lyric at the end of it.
Yeah,
and when I sang that one year, when I sang that once at Chopsticks 3 How Can Be up on Columbia, I remember it was a dead night. There were maybe 10 people in there. It was late. I sang that song, and this old timer, this old, old redneck dude comes up to me. He's crying. He goes, "That was beautiful, man. I'll buy you a drink." And he bought me a drink. He's like, you take care now. It was lovely.
Yeah, I mean, and I think those are kind of the only, the few beautiful experiences you can actually have at a karaoke bar is even if it's dead. You know, and there's just some guy drinking in the corner. You can still sing that song that just means so much to him or her. And
maybe you can.
Well, I mean, and it's funny because it's almost impossible for me to get my wife to go out and sing karaoke with me. But when I do, we do the same thing. And it's awful. And I love it. Is we go and so there's a Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds album called Murder Ballads.
Oh, I know that song, that album. Yeah. Yes.
And yes, they yes. have two awesome duets on there. There's Where the Wild Roses Grow with Kylie Minogue.
Yes.
And there's Henry Lee with PJ Harvey.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It's which really is good. My favorite.
Yeah. I love of course. That
song. It's PJ Harvey.
Yeah. Yeah.
yeah. And now. Kids.
And so what we do is she'll put in a song request for Henry Lee. I'll put in a song request for Where the Wild Roses Grow. So we sing, we go up there, we do murder ballads together as duets where she kills me and then one right kill her. And then we just leave.
That's brutal.
So everyone's having a good time until we finish our last song, and then we walk away.
So how long were you a theater major?
Karaoke bars to me are a special kind of fun. Especially if you go to the ones that are so far out that no one knows about, the ones that I'm not going to say the name on this podcast because then you're going to go there and it's going to become lame. There's
because of you.
One, I'll just say it's somewhere up in Vancouver that I will make a trip out to. It's not the kind of place where you would expect to have karaoke. It's wonderful. You go, there's a KJ, and there's like three people there. Two of which are you and the KJ. And it's wonderful, and you can sing, and you can drink, and it's cheap, and you have a good time.
I mean, there's a place way out on Powell that I've gone to a couple times, and I just remember the KJ there was so excited because I showed up, and I looked different from people way out in that part of the woods.
I know. I think I was there that night, and I think I know the place that you're talking about. Yeah.
And he was so excited to show me his cool new system. He goes, yeah, so you go and you put in, I type in your name here, no, and then it goes and brings up all the history of all the songs you've ever played here just by your name. And it's a cool new system here. I'll show you how it works. And it didn't work. And every time he tried to show it to me, it just like failed miserably. And he's like, okay, well, okay, something's just wrong right here. But he was, but it was just beautiful. And again, one of those nights where there was maybe eight people in the bar between the inside and the outside. And you were like, you know, every third song, you were up again, which is the really fun way to do karaoke.
Yeah. Any thoughts so far, Jacob?
I have a long history of going to karaoke bars. For those of you who have ever heard some of our episodes or some of our outtakes, you'll notice that in actuality, a lot of singing seems to be going on during Biker Dice and Bars recording, and usually there's one voice that is painfully and brutally off key. Well, that'd be me.
Hi, Jacob.
I can't carry a note in a wheelbarrow, let alone a bucket.
I can't carry the tune in a bucket, but I carry that bucket with pride.
I remember the first karaoke bar I went to.
Did you get 86?
No.
For singing?
No. No, but I... Okay. I'll tell that story next. The first time I went to a karaoke bar, I was at a venue club back home called the Pacific Club. I met up with a couple of my friends who were strippers from the strip club next door.
We walked. Like where this is going already.
They wanted to go to the bar next door, which I had never been to, which turned out to be a karaoke bar. And I was there with a couple friends. We met my couple friends who were strippers next door. We went next door. And I listened to one of my friends tear it up on this beautiful, heartrending version of Black Velvet. And she's actually a classically trained singer. It was amazing. It was just beautiful. But I can't sing. I can't sing to save my soul. And so I'm along for the ride. I'll go to karaoke bars, but I want to know they have decent drinks. I want to make sure that enough of the crowd is sober where it's not drunk drawling the entire time.
Oh, boo. But that defeats the whole fun. Boo.
You got to give me at least one good person every once in a while on that.
But no,
boo. I've had friends like...
So bring your friend that can sing. Done. Next.
Which is what I normally do, and I end up being the designated driver often. But no, so that's my experience. And to be honest, I've actually been to a fair number of karaoke bars in this town, but I just don't sing because at that bar, not that particular time, but that first karaoke bar I went to, bartender who was not working their usual night, listened to me get up and sing at the demand of some friends in exchange for covering my entire liquor tab. And he cut me off because he thought I was drunk.
So there was one time I went up to Vancouver, British Columbia, and I think I was in my early 20s at this point in time with my girlfriend at the time, and we were very cheap, so we were trying to find just cheap alcohol somewhere, and we went to where the police of Vancouver told us not to go, which was East Hastings Street, which, have you guys ever been to Vancouver, BC?
I have not.
Okay. So East Hastings Street is... I don't think there's a single neighborhood in Portland that looks as dirty and run down as East Hastings Street is in Vancouver, BC.
Okay.
But it's also where all the cheap alcohol is. So we were walking down there, and out of this bar, we hear this person. We see these couple natives come out of the bar, like, you know, singing Witchy Woman. We're like, cool, okay. And we go in there, and it's a karaoke bar, and it is a bunch of, you know, 60, 70-year-old white, crusty Canadian cowboys and a bunch of, you know, probably 20 to 30-year-old Canadian Native Americans. And okay. That's all this bar is. And they're doing karaoke.
They're not called Native Americans in Canada.
I'm still North America. I don't know what the tribe was, Jacob. I'm sorry. It's North America.
Indigenous peoples, bro. Indigenous peoples.
So we go in there, and all of the old cowboys are singing just nothing but the most old-timey country music ever. And then all of the Canadian indigenous peoples are going and singing like 80s rock.
Yes.
Right on.
It is the weirdest dynamic.
Huh.
And I just went, I love this place. And then the bartender, who was this like giant man that seemed like he might have been ethnic of some sort, had a swastika tattoo on his arm. When we went to go buy drinks, they were so excited that we had American passports that they started being like, oh my God, guys, we have Americans in here. The guy was like, I'm going to buy a round for you guys. And we're like, cool, thanks. And they buy us peppermint schnapps as the good stuff. Oh God. This is what they advertised it as. And I'm like, and all of their drink specials were $2 Canadian a piece, and they were awful. But that place was a great night. And then after I got done singing, this, you know, like 40-year-old woman tried to hit on me next to my girlfriend and then, you know, asked if I could buy her a drink. And I said no. Then she told me to go fuck myself and to go fuck off. And I'm like, I love this place.
That is what we call a dive bar, Xander. That
absolutely was, 100% yeah. Great Canadian dive bar. It didn't even have the name of the bar above the bar. Like it was just an unmarked bar somewhere off East Hastings Street.
Karaoke can lead to really bizarre experiences. And that's one of the things I do like about karaoke bars. I will never forget being in Thunder Bay, Canada, and watching a guy who was a Canadian Crow, a guy who had a swastika on each side of his neck.
What is it with Canada and swastika tattoos, man?
He was actually from Michigan, so... A Pacific Islander and I think he was from the Caribbean, getting up and doing at the top of their drunken lungs chorus of AC/DC's Thunderstruck. They did not know each other before they walked into the bar.
One of my favorite bad karaoke stories is from one of my best friends, again, from my old gaming days, who goes to Japan. And, you know, he's this nerdy white boy, and he gets up at a karaoke bar and starts to sing something. I don't remember what he was singing, but apparently he was singing so bad that like 30 seconds into the song, they cut it off. This old Japanese lady walks up and goes, "No, honey, you sit down. You sit down now." And that was it. Oh, God. No, honey.
So I have... I'll one more karaoke story I will show, and this actually involves Euclid.
Okay.
One of our old mutual friends. So I used to work at Target out in Beaverton back in the day, and we would go to the cheerful pit stop every other Friday because it was paycheck day, and we called it Target Lush Night, and all the cool kids of Target, all like four of us, would go out there and just get shit-faced because we hated our jobs. And this is before the smoking ban there, so I was... You know, I would go up and be really theatrical. And I was singing the Tom Waits song, Going Out West.
Oh.
To which the chorus is, I've got hair on my chest. I look good without a shirt. And so as I'm singing this song.
My theme song.
With the, you know, with a cigarette. And I start to like unbutton my shirt because I've got like to show off my four chest hairs. And.
You were a theater major.
And so by the time I get done singing this song. My button-up shirt is unbuttoned, and I'm going to go sit back down. And this big, you know, probably, you know, 6'2 white jock guy who's like 240 comes up, and he just puts his hand in my chest and goes, put your fucking shirt back on. And I'm drunk, and I look at him, and I look at him, and I kind of like motion over my body, go like, look, dude, if this is turning you on, that's really cool. I don't swing that way, but I'll put my shirt back on. And he goes and he hits me hard in the chest. He goes, I said, put your fucking shirt back on. Oh, and I go, okay, I get it. the ladies are looking at this now, pointing to myself, and they're not looking at you anymore. I'm sorry about that. And at this point, Euclid starts to like grab onto my pectorals to emphasize the fact that the ladies are looking at this now and not him. And then he gets within like an inch of my face and just starts pounding his fingers into my chest. He goes, I said, put your fucking shirt back on. And I look at Euclid and she looks at me and I don't even know what she's going to do. And I just say, you know what? Just do it to her. And she takes a drag off of her cigarette and she puts it out right in my chest. And I take a drag off of my cigarette and I put it out right in her chest. And we just look at the dude. He like gets this wild, scared look in his eyes and just goes, man, you guys are fucked up. And he goes and he sits down and doesn't look at us for the rest of the night.
Yeah.
And then I woke up the next day and just went, ow, my chest, ow.
We'll be revisiting that because I have one of these episodes, I'd love to talk about how to survive a bar fight.
And yeah. Yeah. The answer is be so fucking crazy to the person that can so obviously kick your ass that they're afraid of you.
That's one theory.
This is the last call for alcohol this evening. Drink up, drink up, drink up, and order again. This is the last call for alcohol, get going. Drink up, drink up, drink up, then order again.
Well, closing this out today, I know that Xander is a whiskey snob. Jacob, what do you think about the Royal Crown Royal?
I am mad at the Royal Crown Royal.
Why?
Because the last time Royal Crown made an appearance at this table, I got brutally yelled at by Xander.
It's because you fucking brought Old Crow as well and didn't share until the end.
So is this the time I tell you there's a bottle of Old Crow in my bag again?
I will kill you until you are dead.
No, I actually like this. Having tasted both versions, because listening audience, we actually had Royal Crown Vanilla and Royal Crown Regular.
And we've been alternating as we've been recording.
I find myself
infused with the rich flavor of Madagascar Bourbon Vanilla. The result is uniquely sophisticated whiskey, bursting with the bold flavor of vanilla and the distinctive smoothness of Royal Crown. Sorry.
No. It's one of our things. We should have done that in the intro.
I gotcha.
I think I prefer regular, not vanilla.
Yeah. I like the vanilla. I've had the vanilla. I think the vanilla works really well with a cherry cola. And they had Royal Crown Cherry, and I didn't get it. I wanted to stick traditional. And I only bought the vanilla afterward, when I went to the liquor store and I saw it there, I was like, okay.
You know what? I'm going to go break from both of you. I'm on team vanilla on this one.
I like the vanilla, yeah.
Because it makes me think of a vanilla Coke, or vanilla cola, rather,
yeah.
in this case. And I love vanilla cola. It is, if I don't even want a soda and I wander into a place and they have Pepsi vanilla or vanilla Coke, I will buy that. I will buy that so hard and so fast because I love it.
Especially if it's on the fountain, it just tastes better than from.
I don't think I've ever seen it on the fountain.
Oh, a few places have it.
You know, so I'm going to go break with you guys and go Crown Royal Vanilla is my choice.
Excellent. Now, how does this compare in your mind to Crown Royal Regal Apple?
Crown Royal Regal Apple is a stain upon this earth that I do not even believe that the Third World War will be able to wipe out, that I believe that the cockroaches that eat it will probably turn over and die because the radiation is less toxic to them than Crown Royal Apple.
Well, there goes our chance of getting Crown Royal sponsorship. Thanks.
Crown.
However, Royal Crown, the word's still out.
Crown Royal Vanilla and Royal Crown, however, is a combination that I would actually take.
Excellent. And this is, again, it's Crown Royal. It's not top shelf.
No.
It's Royal Crown. It's not top shelf.
It's a classic. Dive bar.
Yeah, it's
drink.
Classic dive bar drink.
It does depend which bar you're in. I've been in a couple bars where Crown Royal was top shelf.
Oh, well.
Yes.
I bartended at bars where Crown Royal was top shelf.
That's a shame.
I mean, Nathaniel and I went to a bar once where he asked them to give me a double of their finest bourbon. And he goes, so Jim Beam?
Yes.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
Xander would have killed me if I had gotten Crown Royal.
No, you were a nice guy and got me till the more do because you actually value our friendship.
I do. That's why I'm making you drink it tonight. While you're a captive audience here in my home.
You're obligated to be here. Okay.
Well, this has been an interesting tangential evening. We've been kind of...
got a little emotional on this
one.
We got
a little emotional. Yeah. We went to some interesting places that we weren't expecting to go, and I actually had a lot of fun with it.
Yep.
I will say, though, that one of the things I really appreciate about this show and doing it with you guys is that our script is basically, here's a bullet point of a topic we might want to talk about, and that's it.
Yeah.
We have nothing else, and so the free-flowing nature of this is what I really appreciate, because it does go to weird places sometimes, and it's fun.
I love it a lot.
And I think it adds just to the spontaneity of it all.
Mm-hmm. So, Xander, when are you going to join our gaming group?
As soon as I figure out my work schedule.
Excellent.
Which I have some training days to do. And then once that happens, it is definitely a thing I want to do because the American Wasteland Survival Guide.
American Survival Guide. That's American with an
It's pretty fun.
I mean, just because the way you were talking about it a couple episodes ago makes it seem like this is a game that is tailor-made for me.
It sounds like it is. And we're going to some interesting places with it. And we might actually talk more about that campaign in detail in the future. Perhaps a character jam with the USG. Who knows?
And someone did mention on our Facebook page they wanted to hear us play out Tales from the Loop.
Yeah, we've had a number of people that have commented either on our Facebook group or to us personally that they really liked that episode. So
I heard that a lot.
Perhaps we could get a 1-4 shot kind of recording session going.
That would be awesome.
That said, if you like us on Facebook, do us a favor and like us on iTunes, like us on Google Play, like us on wherever you're finding this podcast, because, you know, we're a bunch of hopelessly broken, neurotic people who don't value ourselves unless you like us. No, I'm just kidding. But, you know, if you want to hear this content, if you want to hear more of these character jams, and if you want a hope in hell of me carving time out of my goddamn schedule in order to sit down and do a short run campaign of the loop, I want to see likes.
You let us know what you think about it. Any feedback is welcome. It really helps us out. Reviews are great. Anything. Let us know what you think. Let us know if you got an idea for a future topic. Let us know if you got a game that you want to hear us jam out. Let us know
any questions you want to ask.
Any fan mail, and if you want to see more pictures of Xander, you know, just let us know. And on that note, thank you again for listening to Bikers, Dice, and Bars. I almost said filmed. Recorded here in the Pacific Northwest in Portland, Oregon. Once again, I am Nathaniel, a.k.a. NPC.
Just Jacob.
And Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
Please keep the rubber side down.
Shiny side up.
And always tip your bartender.
And always drink responsibly. And may your dice always roll 20s. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for joining us, friend. We've reached the end of Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes, gamer things and all the like. You can listen to it in your car. The Bikers, Dice, and Bars.
Yep.